And at 6 p.m., thanks for tuning into KCPW for one in a series of political debates we're airing between candidates for public office. Tonight, we air the debate that took place yesterday evening between two candidates vying for a seat at the Utah State Legislature in House District 43, Democrat Diane Lewis and Republican Earl Tanner. This is one of a series of debates sponsored by the ABU Education Fund, an affiliate organization of Alliance for a Better Utah, by the John R. Park Debate Society of the University of Utah, and by KCPW. The debate, which took place at the Tanner Building in West Jordan, was moderated by John R. Park Debate Society Director Michael Middleton.
Good evening. My name is Michael Middleton, and I'm the director of the John R. Park Debate Society at the University of Utah. I'll be your moderator for tonight, the last debate in a series hosted by the ABU Education Fund, KCPW, and the John R. Park Debate Society, and look forward to facilitating a conversation between the two candidates with us tonight who are running for a seat in the Utah Legislature representing House District 43. I'll invite you to welcome them in just a moment, but first I'd like to take an opportunity to introduce the format of tonight's debate. The debate will be organized into three parts. Once the candidates have been welcomed by you, they will each have 4 minutes to introduce themselves. Following that, we'll engage in a moderated discussion during which time each candidate will have an opportunity to answer each question. Their answers will be limited to 2 minutes. The issues the candidates will discuss during this portion of the debate were drawn from issues suggested by each candidate, but members of the U's John R. Park Debate Society wrote the final questions with input from representatives from each of the political parties. However, neither candidate has had the opportunity to preview the questions. Finally, each candidate will have 4 minutes to offer closing remarks. The order of introductions, questions, and closing statements has been predetermined by a coin flip, and there will be a timekeeper who's sitting in the front row of the auditorium. While I'm certain that each of the candidates would like to talk to all of you in the audience tonight, I would like to ask that during each portion of the debate, you refrain from cheering, jeering, applauding, or anything else that might interrupt the debate or the recording, except for right now, when I hope you'll join me in welcoming the two candidates running for the Office of State Representative for Utah House District 43, Republican Representative Earl Tanner and Democratic candidate Diane Lewis. Based on the coin flip, Ms. Lewis will offer her introduction first. It's limited to 4 minutes. Ms. Lewis, the floor is yours.
I don't have to go completely 4 minutes. Well, hi, my name is Diane Lewis, and as you know, I am running for the Utah House of Representatives in our district, District 43. I want to start by saying thank you to the John R. Park Debate Society, KCPW, Marianne Martindale, I just saw her, with Alliance for a Better Utah, Mountain America Credit Union, and for letting us use this great auditorium. Also, I'd like to thank all of you for coming out tonight, because it is people like you that want to have your voices heard that make a difference in Utah. I want to know your vote is important. I moved to Utah nearly 20 years ago. My first grandchild was born, and I just couldn't stay away from her for too long. Now I have two more, and I just live a mile away from them. My son and daughter-in-law are both sergeants in the Utah Highway Patrol. I have lived in West Jordan, just on the other side of the airport, for 11 years now. I am the business manager of Labor's Local 295. This is a construction trade union, and I am honored to represent and advocate for the middle-class working families in our states on a daily basis. I grew up in a middle-class family. My dad was a school bus driver, and my mom worked in a health food store. We lived in a nice home in a safe neighborhood. Every summer, we would take a vacation. When I was a teenager, that was the last thing I wanted to do, was spend a week in a car or a camper with my mom and dad. Now I look back, and those are my greatest memories. We are losing the middle class, with both fathers and mothers having to work not only one job, but sometimes two jobs, just to pay their bills and continue to live paycheck to paycheck. This is not acceptable. When we talk about education and our economy, we talk as if it is separate from one another. They're not separate. We are talking about the middle class. When families struggle to make ends meet, the children suffer in school because their parents' worries now become the children's worries. Children should be able to be children. Children shouldn't worry about finances or whether mom and dad will be home for dinner or even be there to tuck them in bed at night. These are some of the concerns and issues that have been shared with me as I visit our neighbors here in West Jordan, as I go door-to-door campaigning. Fair wage, affordable health care, and a respectable retirement are things that Utahns deserve. I want to be your voice on issues that affect all middle-class families, whether it's education, health care, air quality, public safety, or infrastructure. I am a middle-class Utahn, and I have the same concerns as all of you. Thank you.
Mr. Tanner.
Thank you, Dr. Middleton. My name is Earl Tanner. I'm the Republican representative from District 43. I've been serving now for about 2 years up in the Utah House, elected back in 2012. I am a product of the Salt Lake Valley. I was born and raised here in Salt Lake City. My family has been raised here in West Jordan. I came here as a newlywed, actually, in about 1978. Had three kids, raised them, and I've stayed in that same house for these, what's been now about 36 years. This business of being a politician has been new to me. It's the first time I've run for public office. It's been an education. I've often thought about the legislature as being a place kind of up on Olympus where people speak with great authority and great wisdom. I've discovered that we're actually kind of ordinary people, good people and smart people, but ordinary people that are trying to accomplish something worthwhile and make Utah a better place. I find that in the Republican Party, which of course is the majority party up there, and I also find it in the Democratic Party. There are good people up there. What we're asking us to do, however, is a difficult job. We are getting about 650 bills that we have to do floor votes on every year, and that's a 45-day window for doing it. Now, by profession, I'm a lawyer, and I've been a lawyer now for 38 years. Small office attorney. My clients tend to be individuals and small businesses, and I find myself in court on occasion. What I'm used to is the judicial system where we sit down and think about things very carefully and very precisely and come up with these reasoned decisions. The legislature can't work that way. It's designed to not work that way. And people need to understand that. It's a volunteer job. I think we get paid about $15,000 a year for the time that we spend up there. It cuts into your time in doing whatever else you're doing. I happen to be a solo practice lawyer. So the time I spend up on the Hill is time I don't spend down in the office. And yet it is worthwhile. And you'll find contests like the one that we're having here today, where people are trying to get this job and you might wonder why. The reason why is pretty simple. We have an opportunity to sit at the table and discuss issues that are important to Utah. My cultural DNA is Utah. Both sides of my family go back 160 years in Utah. Before I'm a Republican, I'm a Utah. And I care about what happens to the people here. It has been a pleasure serving in the legislature. It's been a pleasure to associate with the people that I've met up there. It has been a pleasure to discuss things that I often would never have an occasion to discuss unless I had taken on this job in the legislature. It's a pleasure to be here with you tonight, and I'm hoping for a good discussion of some important issues for Utah. Thank you.
Thank you both. The questions we'll address are organized into topical areas, and the first topic is education. Mr. Tanner will speak first on this question. A recent editorial in the Salt Lake Tribune claimed that increasing education funding to allow for smaller classes, especially in early grades, is the best way of improving long-term education outcomes. If elected, what policy proposals would you support to help improve long-term education outcomes?
That's a good question. It's hard to address in just 2 minutes. Actually, the most important period of time for getting good educational outcomes is before they ever reach kindergarten. It's going to happen probably in those first few years before they're 5 years old. And so we have to figure out some way of helping in that, at least encouraging parents to help. I don't think we should be taking children that young out of homes and putting them in schools. However, we have got some proposals. We did one this last legislature, as I recall, in which a private group was willing to put money into improving kind of a preschool program for these younger people. They were going to use their money, and the idea was that they were going to be reimbursed from the savings in remedial work as these children went up through their elementary school age times. I thought it was innovative. I thought it was kind of gutsy, frankly, for the people that were putting their money into it. And my biggest concern is that we make sure the program doesn't get gamed. But if we can keep it honest and it actually turns out well, what better outcome could we have? I think that that is probably the single biggest thing that would help in those conditions.
Ms. Lewis.
Quality education is fundamental to our children's success and success in life, and teachers are the key to that success. People don't become teachers to get rich. They become teachers because they care about our children and they want to make a difference in their lives. We are doing a disservice to not only our children, but to our teachers by having class sizes of 35 to 40 students and by not having the resources to support our teachers. Resources such as supplies for activities and materials for lessons plans. I have a friend that is a teacher. That teacher buys her own colored paper and colored pencils to do activities with the children in the classroom. Another resource that our teachers need is time to grade papers. Because a lot of the kids, in fact, my granddaughter, Sinclair, was always grounded because she didn't get her homework in, and teachers can now check online to see if they, parents can now check online to see if their children are getting their homework in. So time is very important, and so, you know, Sinclair probably didn't turn some of her homework in, but sometimes she did, and the teachers didn't have the time to get that paperwork in. Teachers work at home in the evening and on weekends, which takes away from their family and their personal lives. They need time to relax and prepare for the day ahead and for the week ahead. We are ranked one of the lowest per student spending in the nation. One of the policy issues that I would like to see is to be able to start funding our education system the way it should be funded.
For the next question, we'll continue with the topic of education. An August poll conducted by Dan Jones and Associates and published by Utah Policy found that 41% of Utahans oppose the Common Core, or standards which describe the skills students should know in math and language arts in each grade to be ready for college and careers. Similar polls, however, have suggested that many voters are not fully informed about what the Common Core requires. What is your view on Common Core in light of the ongoing debate? Ms. Lewis.
You know, we have standards in everything that we do in life. Standards when we're building a home, standards when we're building highways. That's what Common Core is. It is strictly a benchmark to ensure our students are college and career ready. The standards are for math and language arts. In 2014, the ACT exam score only said that 39% of our Utah students were ready for college math. That's a struggle. Common Core is not a curriculum. It's up to the local schools and teachers on how the standards are taught. It was actually put together by a group of governors and the education system to bring those standards in. Teachers seem to like it, and parents are struggling with it. While I was calling voters the other night, I spoke with a mother of two boys. Her oldest was excelling in math since the Common Core. Her youngest was actually struggling in math since the Common Core. A father said that he didn't like it at all because it was way too difficult for his child to understand. I spoke to a teacher at the door one day, and she said that she felt it was going to help her students. However, her problem was that the way it was implemented. It was implemented in two phases. Teachers weren't properly trained either to make the transition, and the schools had a hard time finding textbooks and other resources that were compatible with the standard. Change is always difficult. Even if we have everything set in place, I believe we must give Common Core a chance and give our teachers the time, resources, and support to adapt their teaching to the new demands.
Mr. Tanner.
There are a few issues that I've heard about up on the Hill in these last 2 years that have created as much passion as Common Core. Those who are upset about it are really upset about it. And it goes to a lot of issues. It's not just a single thing. The student records, the monitoring, keeping a record from the kindergarten up through occupation, privacy issues that are there are going to have to be addressed. I think they'll probably work themselves out. My personal concern is that we don't make the Common Core the maximum education for our children in the state. As a minimum standard, it's not bad. As a maximum standard, it would be a tragedy. Let me give you an example. One of the people in my district, well, got a lot of teachers in my district. I happen to like the math teachers. I was a math major in college. So I was talking to this elementary math teacher about Common Core because she was upset. She was upset because they were not teaching the kids the 10, 11, and 12 timetables anymore. As a matter of fact, they were covering them up so the kids couldn't see them. They were looking for books that wouldn't have them in them anymore. Struck her as a bad idea. Struck me as a bad idea, too. I asked her to check and see what was going on. And what was happening was this. In the Common Core, they're trying to teach the kids how to do single-digit multiplication tables, 1 through 9. And they're afraid to have them go the extra step on 10, 11, 12, thinking it's too hard for too many kids, I suppose. Now, as a minimum education standard, okay, I don't disagree necessarily with that. But as a maximum standard, you can see where there'd be a problem. So as we go forward, I'm hoping that our Common Core curriculum never becomes the maximum education standard.
Thank you. The next question addresses economic development. In Forbes' most recent ranking of the best states for business, Utah ranked third behind Virginia and North Dakota. What role do you believe the legislature has played in creating a business-friendly environment in Utah? And how, if elected, will you help to continue to sustain and improve Utah's prospects for economic growth? Mr. Tanner.
Well, our prospects for economic growth are tied to a number of things, one of which is simply our demographics. We have one of the youngest populations in the nation. All those years of trying to support kids in school and wondering how we're going to do it are paying off in having a younger population that is talented, well-educated, and a big draw for business coming in. I hope that we continue with that. Things that would tend to force us to have smaller families, things that would tend to dumb down our education system, or things that would hurt us very badly. Now, besides those things, the workforce, which I think is our big, big draw, Utah has a business regulation climate in which we are one of the least regulated in a lot of industries. That's a dicey proposition sometimes. But what it does do is it draws some people into Utah that otherwise wouldn't come. And I want to see that business regulation climate stay friendly. I don't want us to become a protectionist state, which essentially makes business so difficult to do that we drive them off elsewhere. That's happened in California. So I am very pro-business. Obviously, it's how we make our living. It's how the state gets tax money, because if you don't generate money, you don't get tax money to spend in programs, social programs, or others. So it's a matter of keeping the regulation friendly, the tax climate friendly, and making a whole lot of very individual decisions. For example, should sales tax be paid by businesses on the things that they use while they're doing business? Interesting question. We've got kind of a mixed bag answer to it right now. But it is just one of a hundred, if not a thousand, small questions about business that come before the legislature. And the friendliness of the legislature to business is an extremely important matter that I intend to keep up.
Ms. Lewis.
So earlier this year, I went and talked with Mayor Rolfe, the West Jordan mayor here. We had a great conversation about West Jordan and how West Jordan is one of the largest cities in the state. We are, in fact, I think he said fifth largest. You know, as we continue to grow, we grow west because we have so much land west of here that we can continue to grow. Boeing has been brought in. And if you drive down 7800 South and you can drive out and you can see the new Smith Marketplace, I can't wait till it's open. It's going to be amazing. And it's not far from where I live, so it's going to be great. There's also going to be another shopping center out that direction. Mayor Rolfe is interested in West Jordan continuing to grow. He's been looking at trying to do an auto mall up along the Mountain View corridor up there. But he struggles because there is a law in place that says that you can't have auto malls within 15 miles of each other. That's the max, 15 miles. So Mayor Rolfe went to the legislature last year and talked to see if we could compromise and have that auto mall brought out to the west side out here. You know, the west side, when I think about the west side, we have no auto malls at all on the west side. You have to go to either Sandy or into downtown area. And so he would like to compromise and do the 7 miles, but there was a struggle up there. So I think our growth strategy should be looking at letting our communities grow and grow in ways that will give us a great tax base for the city of West Jordan as well, because auto sales definitely bring tax base into our city.
Thank you. Our next question continues on the topic of economic development. In recent years, a number of states have supplemented federal minimum wage laws with required wage increases, while other states have maintained the federal minimum wage. During last year's legislative session, similar laws aimed at increasing wages were unsuccessfully proposed in Utah. If elected, what measures would you support to enhance the economic security of working class Utahns while protecting Utah's strong job growth and business environment? Ms. Lewis.
That's a great question. You know, our minimum wage is $7.25, $7.50. I can't ever remember what it is. You know, it used to be that $7.50 was for our high school students. You know, when I was 16, that's the first thing I did was go to work it wasn't Colonel Sanders at that time, and they don't even call it that anymore, it's KFC. But that's where I worked. And so I was able to go and make a living on minimum wage because I lived at home and I didn't have any bills. But now, with the way the economy is, adults are taking those jobs because adults have to work two jobs to make a living a lot of the times because they're working, you know, they have so much that they have to do and the cost of living has gone so high that now adults are taking that. I believe that we need to look at a way to raise the minimum wage. I don't think that we should take a big, huge jump. Because, you know, we talk about small business and things like that, and we don't want to hurt the small business. However, what we do want to do, we want to have a middle class back. We want to have people to be able to work and make a living, come home, take care of their children. And that's what I think is important. So I think if there was a way that we could slowly raise, maybe with the cost of living, and raise that minimum wage as the cost of living was raised.
Mr. Tanner.
The minimum wage, I think, is the wrong place to focus. The right place to focus is the median wage. In Utah, from Department of Labor statistics, our median wage, and by median, let me explain, this means that half the people in the state make more than this and half the people make less than this, okay? The number is $16. So half the people in the state are making $16 or more and half are making $16 or less. And the wage jobs. If we push that number up, that's what I think the policy ought to be directed to. $7.25, which is the federal and Utah minimum wage, is the wage that we pay for jobs that are not the jobs that we value very highly. As an employer over the years, I run into the thing that any employer is going to run into. You get a better quality employee usually by paying more money. You're competing for it. And so I can't think of anybody who has skilled employees who's paying them $7.25 an hour, at least not in my little piece of the world. And so I end up paying quite a bit more. As we increase the skill level of our people, we're going to increase that median wage. And I think that median wage is what we should keep our eye on. The minimum wage, if we start knocking it off, we're kidding kids out of, you know, beginner jobs, the jobs that don't have a great deal of, don't have much compensation, and give kids a reason to get out of them and move on to a higher one. If we start pushing that up too high, we're going to make it hard for the small businessmen to get started because they depend on that low-cost labor to get going. And again, I think we focus on the wrong thing by focusing on the minimum wage. The right focus is the median wage.
Thank you. Again, with economic development, Utah's population is projected to grow by 67% by 2040. What strategies can the legislature employ to responsibly and effectively manage this growth? What initiatives would you support, if elected, to help manage and encourage growth? Mr. Tanner.
I'm not sure I caught all of that, Dr. Middleton. What would I do to encourage economic growth?
Growth is projected to grow by 67% by 2040. What sort of policies would you support to help effectively manage that growth?
You're talking about growth and population?
Population, yes, sir.
Okay, the population growth. Thank you, I'm sorry. Well, of course, we have things like Envision Utah, and we're envisioning making higher density housing the solution to the problem. I have to admit that I would not like to live in high density housing, and I have some problems with making that the official solution. More than simply the increase in growth in the population, I think the important question is the difference in composition of the population. We have had historically here a predominantly European white population. I mean, it's been changing. It's in the process of changing. It's going to be changing more as we enter into these years and that population grows by that 67%. As we bring in these other cultures, they do life a little differently. They often think of their values are not exactly the same as the old indigenous population. And one of our biggest single challenges is in encouraging them to get their education, to keep them in school. We have a horrible dropout rate among the Latino community from high school. We're not getting them into college. They're not graduating anywhere near the rates that we have with the rest of the population. That is a challenge, and getting them, encouraging them to get a good education, get into college, and be maximally participating in our culture has got to be one of our priorities. It just has to be. These people are important. They've got a lot to contribute to the society, and we've got to find ways of adapting in the education area primarily, but also in accommodating some diversity, because we're right in the middle of getting a lot more diversity than we've ever had before.
Ms. Lewis.
So as we continue to grow, I think the first things that we need to do is look at infrastructure, because infrastructure is going to be very, very important as we grow. And I'm talking not just about highways and building new highways. I'm talking about we need to start looking at water main lines. We just had two water main lines break, and right over here in West Jordan, and then one on the east side. We need to start looking at maintaining those and repairing those and making those stronger, because as our population goes, we're going to definitely be adding more water, needing more water. And we need to start looking as well at some of the, I'm trying to catch my notes here, at finding jobs as we continue to grow. And what I mean by jobs is fair jobs with fair wages. Also to offering health care and offering a healthy retirement program. I shouldn't say healthy, a nice retirement program, because we don't want to work through the rest of our life. So I think it's important that as we grow, we start looking around and making sure that we're doing the right things before we do grow, and we be ahead of that curve.
Thank you. We'll address infrastructure more in a moment, but before we do, we have a couple of questions about taxes in Utah. The first is for you, Ms. Lewis. According to the Tax Foundation, Utah's state and local governments collect $822 per person on average from income tax, which ranks 24th lowest nationally. Where do you stand on Utah's comparatively low tax burden? What, if any, changes to the state's tax code would you propose if elected? Ms. Lewis.
Me. I'm going to struggle with this question. I am not a legislator yet, and I will be looking into that as we go along. But we have a flat tax right now, and our flat tax is basically 5%. I don't think that's enough to continue to fund what we need to fund, and I think that we should go back to the other tax rates. So I'm sorry, I'm struggling with this one, and I will definitely learn more about this as I become a legislator.
Mr. Tanner.
I am not in favor of substantial increases of our income taxes. If you look back historically, when we changed over to the flat tax, what we did at the same time is we closed a bunch of loopholes. I don't know how many of you were here in Utah during that time, but most of us found that with this lower flat tax rate, we were paying more state taxes. And that tax rate at 24th is right comfortably in the middle. That doesn't bother me much at all. Compared to some of our neighbors, I would point out that Nevada doesn't have an income tax, and neither does Wyoming. Ultimately, what you're asking is, where are you going to be collecting the taxes? And in Utah, the system has had three legs on the stool. One has been the income tax. The other has been the sales tax. And the third has just left my mind as I'm sitting here trying to talk about it. We've got the property taxes, of course. Sorry. What we're doing is we're distributing that load over those three different kinds of taxes. And as you change that around, you change the mix of people who are carrying the load. If we make a very substantial increase in the income tax, people are going to be, well, frankly, that's money off the table in these middle-class households that I think both my opponent and I want to keep as healthy as we can. I am not going to be voting for increases in the income tax. I am going to be trying to keep it as balanced as we can be. There will be needs to raise income as we go along. But hopefully we can also at the same time become more efficient in how we provide government services and try and keep everything in balance.
Thank you. The next question is also about taxes, and it's rather specific, but you all suggested the topic, so. During the last legislative session, the legislature entertained House Bill 372, aimed at taxing electronic cigarettes in a similar fashion to traditional cigarettes. That legislation failed to pass. Many other states like Utah have limited regulation while awaiting guidance from the FDA. Given this, what steps would you take in regard to regulating and/or taxing e-cigarettes if elected? Mr. Tanner.
Well, the business behind taxing e-cigarettes is a little bit about raising revenue, and it's a lot about public health. E-cigarettes, of course, are just another mechanism for delivering nicotine. And the concern that we've had as a society, really, if you read, there's a lot of literature on it, is that what we've done is we've opened up a new pathway for young people to become addicted to nicotine. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, we've got all these older folks who got smoking on regular tobacco cigarettes. And the belief is that they're probably better off if they're doing e-cigarettes instead of the tobacco. There's less the carcinogenic material that they're breathing in. And so I see it as two things that we're trying to accomplish. We're trying to encourage people who've been smoking regular cigarettes to shift over and hopefully get off their nicotine habits. But it's a very tough habit to break. And we're trying to protect our children from getting hooked on nicotine as they're growing older. Unfortunately, the e-cigarettes have been marketing just to these young people. It's suave, it's electronic, it comes in nice flavors. It looks like an exciting thing to try. And in fact, it's just the drug dealer with a different thing, trying to lure somebody in to get hooked on his product and then sell it to them for the rest of their lives. We need to stop doing that. Now, I'm hoping that the answer is going to come from the FDA. and that will be treated as other tobacco products. I support taxing e-cigarettes simply as a means for raising the price, and by raising the price, reducing the amount of consumption that we have here in the state. We have to keep our eye on the ball here. It's not about revenue. It's about public health.
Ms. Lewis.
I agree, Ms. Representative Tanner, completely. It is about health. Right now, you know, they are doing that study on whether to tax them or not. But it's about the health issues. And, you know, I remember as a kid growing up, cigarettes were the thing to do. Now it's the e-cigarettes. I have a friend, in fact, Brendan and I have a friend. Her name is Katie Hogue, and she was a smoker, and she decided that she was going to try and get off smoking, and she was going to go to the e-cigarette. Well, she's still smoking the e-cigarette, and it's been a couple years now, so she actually hasn't gotten off of smoking. And, you know, we're reaching out to kids, and I've heard about resource officers at school, and what they're doing is they're literally going around and taking them from the children when they see them, and they're coming out at the end of the day carrying a full bag of e-cigarettes. They're flavored. They're, you know, I don't know anything about those e-cigarettes, but I've seen a couple of them, and it is most definitely a health issue. And if we tax it, you know, that'll be fine and good, but I think that what we need to do is make sure that we're watching our children and not getting them addicted. Nicotine is harder to get off than heroin, and I can attest to that because I was a smoker when I was young because I thought it was cool, so... Thank you.
For our next question, we'll switch to a discussion of infrastructure. The Ogden Standard Examiner recently reported on a study conducted by the Reason Foundation, which found that Utah had declined three rankings to 29th nationally in its overall highway performance and the cost effectiveness of the state's transportation infrastructure. What, in your view, should the legislature do to ensure that Utahns get the most bang for their buck as it relates to investments in transportation infrastructure? If elected, what policies would you pursue to ensure these outcomes? Ms. Lewis.
So infrastructure is basically what I do for a living. I am in the construction trades union, as I said. Most of our I-15 has been taken care of. Highways repaired, highways replaced, all the way down from Pace and all the way up to Ogden. And the gap at the point of the mountain should be done by spring of 2015 if we can get the funding. However, there are many other roads out there. I went to a transportation, the governor's transportation summit last year, and some of our bridges in rural Utah are over 50 years old. There's one that's 100 years old. And for me, that's not a bridge that I would want my family driving on. Yes, it's in rural Utah, but rural Utah is beautiful, and there's no reason that you wouldn't want to take a drive out in that area. Again, I spoke about the rail projects. The rail projects have been amazing. I mean, we have such great rail projects right here in West Jordan, and we definitely need to fund more rail projects. So I think that we need to be proactive in repairing. And, you know, when I talked about the water main lines, that's another thing. That's part of infrastructure, and I think it's important that we go ahead and start repairing and maintaining all of these things. And I support that we start looking at ways to fund, to fund infrastructure, because we definitely need infrastructure. And one thing, again, that I'll talk about is the mayor of West Jordan is looking at widening 7800 South and actually taking it all the way from one end up to the Mountain View Corridor. Another project that we need to fund is the Mountain View Corridor. It is absolutely amazing, and then it dead ends right there at 5600 South. The bridges that we did here in West Jordan was an amazing thing to keep Bangor just driving. We need to do that all the way along Bangor. So these are things that I would support.
Thank you. Mr. Tanner.
Transportation. Takes about 7% of our budget statewide, and that's out of a $13.5 billion budget. You'd think that that's a lot of money and we could get it done, but the fact of the matter is that it's not enough for what we're facing. In Utah, we do advanced planning. I think some of our road and transportation planning is some of the best in the nation, really. We have a group of people that statewide look at what's needed and come up with a plan on how to develop those state resources. I'm trying to recall exactly what the figure was. It was big. It was something like an $11 billion shortfall over the coming years, and that was on a 20-year plan, if I remember right. In what was needed versus what was going to be brought back in revenue. That means that we've got to do some repairs to how we fund our transportation system. It's been falling behind. Two big reasons. Our cars are getting more efficient, and a big piece of the revenue is coming from the gas tax. Less gas pumped, less tax money collected. And the other one is that we've had inflation over the years, but that gas tax has been flat for a long time. It's a really unpopular idea, but we're going to have to figure out some way to raise revenue above where it is. Johnny Anderson over from the Transportation Committee, that I sit on, by the way, has been negotiating, trying to come up with a better way of doing it. We couldn't do it in the last committee meeting. The reason was we had an election coming up, and we were talking about raising taxes, no matter how you dress it up. Nobody wanted to do that. But we're going to have to face it. It's there. There's no getting around it. And whether we do it through some kind of mileage rate or some other system, we've got to adjust. It's got to be done.
Thank you. The next question addresses health care. In recent months, Governor Herbert's Healthy Utah Plan has received a great deal of attention in the statewide press. The Salt Lake Tribune reports that in an independent poll conducted over the summer, over 70% of Utahns indicated that they preferred Herbert's plan as opposed to a straightforward Medicaid expansion. What is your position on this proposal? If elected, what policies would you support to help ensure access to health care for Utah's low-income citizens? Mr. Tanner.
Well, I have been, when I ran 2 years ago, I ran partly on a commitment to investigate whether or not we should expand Medicaid. It's a complicated question. It's not just one-dimensional. And I've spent the last 2 years trying to get on top of that question. Jim Dunnigan is tired of me asking as many questions of him as I do. It's not just about, well, there are three things that have stood out to me. The first is that we've got a population, the people, primarily individuals, who are making less than $12,000 a year, who don't have any coverage in our current healthcare system. I think everybody's agreed that we need to do better for them than we've been doing. A large portion of that population has mental illness. That's the reason they're there. And we don't have a good system for dealing with the mentally ill outside of our jails and our criminal system. Now, that is atrocious. You get them into jail, you get them some decent treatment, you finally get them out of jail, and suddenly they're back on the streets with nothing that's going to help them go forward again. The social services coordinator for mental health for Salt Lake County pleads with me every time we meet to support getting something like Medicaid expansion done. I think Governor Herbert is on the right path. We ought to do something about this. Whether it's precisely the plan that he's proposing or not is something that has to be vetted through the legislature. We're going to talk about it. I don't think we should talk about it in a special session, because part of that conversation is who's going to pay the freight. The freight, by the way, is about $40 million a year state tax money that draws in about another $105 million a year of federal money, which gets paid to people in private industries for their jobs. Having that conversation is going to take us a little longer than a special session.
Ms. Lewis.
Well, as of yesterday, when I looked online, we have lost $220 million of health care funding from the federal government. That is $796,789 per day. That would cover over 110,000 people of uninsured Utahns. I spoke to a grandmother the other day on the phone about health care. She was telling me about her son who has a good job. He's working regularly. He's been offered health care benefits for himself and his family at work. His wife is struggling with health issues and she can't work. They have two small children, but if they buy health coverage for them and their family, they can't afford to eat or pay their bills. With their income, they can qualify for Medicaid for their children, but that does not help her daughter-in-law at all, because she can't have health care. They can't go to the exchange because they've been offered health care through their job. It's stories like this breaks my heart. One of the saddest things that I think we have, what I've heard about not expanding Medicaid when we should have, is we've had over 100 deaths since we haven't expanded the Medicaid. I think Governor Herbert's Healthy Utah Plan is a great alternative for our state, but we must start taking action soon, because if we don't, we're going to lose more lives, and I can't see us doing that.
Thank you. The next question addressed air quality in Utah. While efforts to improve Utah's air quality seem to be gaining ground, the winter of 2013 witnessed record-level spikes in pollution, especially in the Salt Lake Valley. The Deseret News recently reported on a plan by Senator Scott Jenkins and Representative Steve Handy aimed at easing access to emission-reducing CNG conversions for motorists in Utah. Where do you stand on this particular proposal? What other policies would you pursue, if elected, to help improve Utah's air quality? Ms. Lewis.
You know what? We are so lucky to live in this Salt Lake Valley in this beautiful state. Salt Lake Valley is breathtaking with the Wasatch Mountains, and they surround us on all sides. However, it's also a downside, because it creates a bowl to where it actually holds those inversion in. And it gets pretty bad, as they said just now. There's days when, you know, you can actually smell the smog, is what I call it, because I grew up in LA, but I call it smog, but it's the inversion. It becomes hazard to the health of all our residents. And it's also something that needs to be addressed quickly and smartly. As our state continues to lead in population growth, we need to see to it now that our pollution doesn't get worse. The biggest argument not to pass laws to improve our air quality has been that the legislation would have a negative effect on economic growth. However, the air quality itself is a serious negative effect on that development. I believe a plan to improve our air quality legislatively must be include encouraging growth strategies that result in less dependence on motorized vehicles, improved mass transit, and alternative modes of transportation that would better serve urban commuters, increased support for carpooling lanes, and stricter diesel fuel emissions. And, you know, another great idea would be on red days, how about free transportation on the tracks line? We could do something like that, and that would help as well. You know, and I'm just going to go off here. Just went and saw a great movie called Pump. Did you know that in 1996, our cars are actually flex fuel cars, and we have no way to get that flex fuel? We should look at starting to put that in our gas stations, because that would also help our air quality.
Mr. Tanner.
Thank you. The legislature, I think, has given some incentives for conversions over to CNG. The problem is that you're not going to address air quality control with that little piece of the problem. The big gorilla in air quality is going to be the Tier 3 engines and the Tier 3 fuels that are coming on, I think, in 2017 anyway, in the next few years. What these new engines do in connection with lower sulfur fuel, which is what the Tier 3 fuels are, is that they drastically reduce the emissions again. Because most of our air pollution is coming out of tailpipes, that is the big gorilla that we have to keep an eye on. Now, the problem that we have in Utah is that our refineries don't make Tier 3 fuels yet. And Tier 3 fuel is an expensive change for the refineries to make. They have to buy a lot of expensive new equipment to do it. So the biggest single thing we can do is to try and encourage ways to get that Tier 3 fuel into Utah, whether it's locally manufactured or however else we can get it here. We need the combination of Tier 3 engines and Tier 3 fuels. That's the biggest thing. Now, after that, there's a lot of little things you can do, but they're relatively little. There are such things as water heaters, believe it or not. Some water heaters pollute a lot, some water heaters pollute a little. I didn't know that until I started talking with some of the people up in the House that are working hard on air quality questions. And I'd like to point out one other thing about this, just in a matter of passing. Air quality has become something that the Republicans have taken up as much as the Democrats. The two biggest people up there that are pushing for air quality are probably Ed Redd, a Republican, and Patrice Arendt, a Democrat. It's one of those bipartisan issues that's going through, and I think will continue to be an important issue up at the legislature.
Thank you. We're at the last question, and it's your opportunity to tell the audience what I should have asked you. Mr. Tanner, what do you see as the central challenges facing the legislature in the upcoming legislative session next January? If elected, how will you use your seat in the legislature to help effectively manage these challenges?
Well, as I said, there's 650 bills that we got floor votes on each session, so coming up with just one of them is a bit of a challenge. I think one of the most important ones is going to be the question about expansion of Medicaid, you know, down to this 0 to 100. I believe, from talking with the leadership, that we'll probably end up having it there, having a discussion in the session on that, partly because we need the time to discuss how we're going to pay for it. One of the possibilities is that the hospitals, and primarily the hospitals, are going to be benefiting from all this new money coming through, maybe willing to contribute some to the tax load that it takes us to do the expansion. There needs to be a little basic model negotiating done, and it can't be done in a special session. After that, there are a lot of things that we've talked about today, the e-cigarettes, how do we deal with those? Taxation issues come up all the time. The transportation, I think, is going to be one of the higher ones on my radar because it's coming down the road. We need, literally, and we need to figure out how we're going to be paying for that. It's going to take a lot of negotiation. There's a lot of players in this, and the people who buy and sell the fuel right in the middle of it. I'm hoping to see us get a better solution there as we transition. We're going to be getting the things that we have to worry about in transportation. I'm sorry to go back to that one, but it is something that's important to me. We're going to be getting diversified fuels. Right now it's mostly gasoline, a little bit of ethanol. We're going to start seeing some liquefied petroleum over the next few years. We're trying to get CNG into the mix, but most of all, we're getting the electric hybrids, especially the plug-in hybrids. And we've got to adapt to that with regard to our transportation funding.
Ms. Lewis.
So I think some of the main issues are also going to be education. I think the Medicaid expansion as well, and I agree with Representative Tanner. I think transportation are going to be probably the three main ones. And for me and my role as a legislator, I want to be a champion for the middle class families. I want to see things change that we no longer have people working two jobs and that they are able to make a living strictly on one job and that it is fair wage. Education is going to be key to that as well because education affects everything. And those, you know, when we talk about these issues, there's so many other issues that affect each other and one in the same. And so I think it's important that we you know, continue to talk about how are we going to fund education. And you know, Mr. Tanner, Representative Tanner talked about taxes. That's probably going to be another one that we're going to have to talk about because it is it's, you know, that's where we get education funding is from taxes. That's where we get transportation funding is from taxes. So it will be a big issue up there on the Hill. And Medicaid expansion or the Healthy Utah, we need to talk about that. And I want to be a big part of all of that and learn all that I can. Thank you.
Thank you. We've now arrived at concluding statements, and Mr. Tanner, you get to go first.
Serving in the legislature is a privilege. It's a burden, but it's also a privilege. What I bring to the table, and I try to bring to the table, is a sense of being a moderate Republican. Back in the days when I was running for the first time, people told me there's a few things that you should never tell anybody in your district because then they won't vote for you. The first thing is never tell them you're a lawyer. Everyone hates lawyers. Well, okay. But the fact of the matter is I'm a lawyer. And I personally think it's a good thing to be a lawyer. I pay about over $1,000 a year just to keep a great big annotated copy of the Utah Code within arm's reach. And I spend a lot of time looking through it, trying to figure out what it says about things. So I tell people that I'm a lawyer. I don't hide it. The second thing they told me is you better never tell them that you're a moderate Republican because nobody likes moderate Republicans. Okay. Simple fact of the matter is, I'm not a Tea Party Republican. I'm a moderate Republican. And for better or worse, that's who I am, and that's what I advertise myself as. I'm somebody who can seriously consider Governor Herbert's Healthy Utah plan and see that it has some virtue. So the secret, I think, to serving well in the legislature is to be open about who you are and what you are and what you think. You're going to get more ideas than you ever imagined possible coming at you, usually from people with an element of self-interest. The trick of the job is to keep your sense of balance. Keep your opinion of yourself very low and your concern for the people of Utah very high. Those are skills that I've tried to learn as an attorney over these last 38 years in representing people, because it's not about the lawyer, it's about his client. In this case, my client are the people of Utah, and they are people that I would like to continue to serve, and your support would be very appreciated.
Ms. Lewis.
I want to start out by thanking Representative Tanner for joining me tonight. This has been an absolutely wonderful experience, and I'm so grateful to have had this opportunity. I've never done anything like this before, and I'll tell you what, it's been way out of my comfort zone. I've learned so much during this campaign about my neighbors and about West Jordan. Every one of the issues that we just spoke about is vital to our district and to Utah. They are separate issues. However, each one affects the other. And even then, there are many other issues we haven't even begun to touch on. In turn, these issues affect our lives in many ways. Right now, in the Utah House of Representatives is controlled by a supermajority, as Mr. Tanner said earlier. This creates an unbalanced government and impedes the democratic process. I want to represent District 43, and I want to assure you now, you will always know exactly where I am on every single issue. I am willing to have those hard conversations to understand where you're at on issues, and I want to hear both sides. I may not, we probably won't always agree. However, it is important for us to have those conversations. We need diversity in our government. There is no one person that is an expert on everything. We need farmers, nurses, and even labor leaders in our federal government. I mean, in our local government. I'm talking federal government here. So collectively, they can make the best informed decisions they can on issues that affect our lives every single day. It is important that you know me, and I know what concerns you have for our community and our state. So I will continue to visit with our mayor and police chief. I will have town hall meetings so that we can have conversations, and I most definitely want you to call me if you think I'm doing anything crazy up there on the hill. This is about all of us, not one of us. When we come together as a community, we have a louder voice, and together we can make a difference. As you look at my yard signs up there, my logo has two words on it that say that I absolutely love: passion and integrity. I promise you that I have the passion to work hard and the integrity to do the right thing and take full responsibility for my actions. I ask for your vote in November, and let's go build a better Utah.
That concludes tonight's debate. Before you leave, join me once again in thanking both Diane Lewis, the Democratic candidate, and Representative Earl Tanner, the Republican candidate running for a legislative seat representing Utah House District 43.
And thanks for listening to that debate here on KCPW this evening. Don't forget to vote.